Remember those science fiction stories about traveling to Mars, mining in outer space, and other far-out ideas? Well, they're not so far out anymore, and the commercialization of the cosmos will be here before we know it, according to Tim Marshall, author of the new book, The Future of Geography: How the Competition in Space Will Change Our World. Tim is a British journalist, author, and broadcaster specializing in foreign affairs and international diplomacy, and is the founder and editor of the current affairs site, thewhatandthewhy.com. Here he is to share five of his key insights.
Hello, I'm Tim Marshall. I'm from the UK, a former foreign correspondent, but about 10 years ago, I switched to long-form writing. I'm trying to mesh my experiences in places such as Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and indeed the USA, with a geographic underpinning for the events which happen there. I'd like to share with you five of the key insights in my latest book, The Future of Geography. Insight 1. The Space Race 2.0. It's different this time. At the heart of the space race of the 1960s was each side, the Soviets and Americans, each trying to prove that its political system and technologies, scientists, its resolve, was superior to the other. Well, we know how that went. That space race was overwhelmingly led by the governments. This time, there's less ideology, more actors, and far more of a commercial and military rationale. This time, major companies such as Elon Musk's SpaceX are front and centre in both the commercial aspects of the new race, but also in helping NASA return to the moon. Satellites are now part of a country's critical infrastructure, tied to their economic activity, indeed the global economy. And for many countries, their war-fighting capabilities. Over the next decade, tens of thousands of satellites will be launched for both commercial and military reasons. We need these machines for our GPS systems. Ships and planes are guided by them. So's your Uber driver. And the people who drive the food to the supermarkets. Many of us receive our TV and radio programs from them. Space may be infinite, but low Earth orbit, where most satellites fly, is not. Sure, it's still an enormous area, but it could get crowded. Insight 2. Mining the moon. The phrase, "there's gold in them thar hills," is attributed to a character in Mark Twain's 1892 novel, The American Claimant. The actual quote about the mountains in North Georgia is, "there's millions in it." Well, when it comes to the moon, both are true. There is gold on the moon, but that's not what people are after. There's silicon, iron, titanium, lithium, and more in them thar hills. And some of it is at the lunar South Pole, where there's something else precious. Water. Good thing, water. You can drink it, you can extract oxygen from it, and you can extract hydrogen. All very useful should you want to build a moon base. And the US and China both intend to have such things by the early 2030s. In 2026, NASA says we'll see American astronauts, a man and a woman, walking on the surface of the moon. In the longer term, its surface is expected to be the launch pad for getting to Mars. In the short term, countries and companies are after the potential riches to be found on the moon. Many of the elements there are the very things we need for our 21st century technologies, including those involved in renewable energy. Now, the economic viability of this is another thing. It'll cost a fortune to get there, and a fortune to dig the stuff up, even if getting it to Earth, probably in the form of a space shuttle, is slightly cheaper, as it doesn't require much rocket fuel. But which technologically advanced country can afford the risk of not being there and allowing their competitors getting what is in a way the 21st century version of oil? This is part of the geography of space. There's parts you want to avoid. There are distances, terrains, gravitational slingshots. Geography's always important. It's only where the important bits are that changes. Insight 3. The Big Three. More than 80 countries now have a presence in space, but the Big Three are the USA, China, Russia, in that order. They are the space superpowers. Now, the USA remains in the lead, but China is off the launch pad and accelerating. Russia? Russia will decline in space exploring terms, but it'll plough most of its rubles, most of its space budget, into the military aspects of its space industries. Now, those three are way out in front. There's a second tier. In it, there's countries such as Italy, France, the UK, the UAE, Israel, Japan, others. Now, India has established itself as a leading player in this group, especially by boldly landing a spaceship where no one has landed a spaceship before, the Lunar South Pole. Now, that was quite a feat. The US landed in the Sea of Tranquility, which, yeah, was rocket science and incredibly, amazingly successful, and what a technological achievement in the 1960s. But the Sea of Tranquility is flat, relatively speaking, easier to land on. The South Pole is strewn with giant boulders, ravines, caves. It's got mountains, and no one had ever landed there until the Indians did it. Quite an achievement. Now, in the third tier, well, there's dozens of countries there, but their presence in space is restricted to satellites. For example, Nigeria. It now makes its own cube satellites. Many of these are just the size of a Rubik's Cube. Build 20 of them, put them in, for example, a SpaceX rocket, share the area in the rocket with several other countries doing likewise, and once in orbit, deploy your mini satellites in a constellation. The price of having a presence in space has gone down because you can share the launch costs with others and because SpaceX has pioneered how to bring rockets back to Earth, land them, and reuse them. They've even done it with two rockets at the same time. So countries can now use these constellation of satellites to help small-scale farmers know where best to plant crops. They're used to help plan road and rail networks to link countries, which often struggle to trade with each other. Africa's a good example. The geography of Africa has not really been helpful to forging a continent-wide economic system. But if your satellites are telling you exactly where to put that road at the best cost, it helps. Well, perhaps in time some of these states will have the budgets for space exploration, perhaps even to profit from the potential riches of extracting minerals from the moon. But there's a problem. We're talking about finite resources. First come, first served. Things aren't always fair on Earth. Why would they be so in space? Insight 4. War in space. The first Gulf War is sometimes called the First Space War. American missiles fired into Saddam Hussein's Iraq were mostly guided by satellites. The Russia-Ukraine War might be called the first war in which both sides have access to space assets. Russia has its own satellite network for surveillance, targeting, and guiding missiles. Ukraine has been offered satellite imagery by friendly countries and has bought in imagery from commercial outfits. This has thrown up something new. In the first few days of the war, Russia took out the internet in large parts of the Irpin region in Ukraine. SpaceX flew in thousands of terminals capable of receiving its Starlink satellite internet service. Fine. Civilians can now contact loved ones, organise evacuation columns, etc. But of course the Ukrainian military jumped on the service and used it to target Russian troops. So, question. Does that make Starlink a legitimate military target for Russian forces to aim at? Well, they thought so. No Starlink satellite has been shot down, but from early in the war, Russia has been trying to dazzle the satellites with laser beams fired from Earth. Most modern satellites have the capability to close the lens on their cameras when they sense a strong direct light. Think of it as blinking. So Starlink and Russia have been playing cat and mouse ever since. However, coming soon, more powerful lasers, ones capable of burning through to the computer chips in the satellites. Also coming soon, a range of dual-use machines in space. For example, space debris is a huge problem. There's so much metal flying around the world that it's a constant danger to the satellites and the International Space Station. One way to get rid of some of the bigger bits, such as a defunct satellite, is to use another satellite with grappling arms to seize it and throw it into the atmosphere to burn up. Japanese and the Europeans are working on such machines. Fine. But what if your grappling-armed satellite is creeping up behind my functioning satellite, the very one which has part of my nuclear early warning system in it? The Space Force units many countries now have are not yet about actually firing at each other in space, especially as that would add to the debris. But that may come down the line. For now, Space Forces are used to enhance the capabilities of a country's armed forces on Earth. But if one major country decides to arm its satellites, most others will follow suit. Insight 5. If only we had laws about this. We do. They're out of date. We do have the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, and it's not a bad template for new treaties, which would be fit for the 21st century, but it hasn't really kept pace with technology or with economics. The Outer Space Treaty does say that no country can have sovereignty over space, the moon, or any planets. But it's far less clear when it comes to commercial companies. Say, for example, Toyota built vehicles capable of carrying several people on the moon. They got together with a Japanese mining company and a space company. They got to the lunar South Pole. They dug up a shuttle's worth of lithium and brought it home. Well, that stuff's part of the moon. And you can't own the moon. Can they sell it? Well, the US-led Artemis Accords are supposed to give us guidelines about this and other tricky questions, but to date only 29 countries have signed up to them, and China and Russia have not, nor will they be, and they have their own views. And that satellite with grappling arms? How close can it come to another satellite? We have guidelines to prevent collisions. A potential collision could be seen at the very least hours in advance, and a small course correction can put miles of distance between two satellites. But that's different to agreeing how close you can come to a security asset without it being seen as a threat. There's a lack of clarity and agreement. It's not all negative. We use space also for many activities of real benefit to humanity. Satellites measure the temperature of the oceans to know more about climate change. We do medical experiments in space which save lives here on Earth. We've successfully deflected an asteroid to test if we might be able to do so for one that was actually heading for us. Think, do look up. And going back to the moon? Well, that's the path, you know, for having a planet B, in case this one wears out. And we, well, Caltech, have proved a concept. They've captured the sun's rays in space on a solar panel, turned the energy into a microwave, sent it to a receiving dish in California, turned it back into energy, and powered a light bulb. Remember, it's 24 hours a day sunshine in space. If we can scale that, goodbye fossil fuels. Thanks for listening. If a copy of The Future of Geography comes your way, I hope you like it.
Thank you, Tim. That was Tim Marshall with 5 big ideas from The Future of Geography, How the Competition in Space Will Change Our World. Also, check out our booklet for Off Earth, Ethical Questions and Quandaries for Living in Outer Space by Erica Nesvold. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.